can answer in 5-6 months. Now, this is not the question yet. This is a general assumption, but I want to really start by responding maybe to some words that have been said this morning about scaling and why scaling is at all relevant and the key and the light, etc. And really, I mean, when you think about it, in broad strokes, there are two issues that deserve our thinking. And I agree very well with the first speaker this morning that one of the issues to be discussed and understood is the following question: given the small-scale structure, how can we predict the large-scale transport properties? So that's going from small scale to large scale is a valid question. I think that the subject is open, and I hope that maybe we can say something about this within the next 5-6 months. But there's certainly another issue that is intellectually as interesting and is the opposite. Given large scale forcing or large scale properties, how can we predict the small scale structure? It's in some sense the opposite, infrared versus ultraviolet. And although it's obvious to everybody that the energy is concentrated on the large scales, it doesn't mean that the intellectual excitement is concentrated as well on the large scales, because there is an issue that has to be understood. We have large scale forcing, we observe small scale statistics, and what we observe does not agree, or apparently does not agree, with what a Kolmogorov type theory predicts. So we need to understand why it doesn't agree, how to form a correct way of thinking, how to provide tools for the analysis and the discussion of the small-scale statistics. Now, when I talk about the small-scale statistics and understanding, I want to make very clear in this discussion today that one can discuss the computation and one can discuss the mechanism, that is to say. And I want to make this distinction clear, sort of propose maybe one can actually focus, one of the questions that I would like people to focus in this program is about the physical mechanism for anomalous scaling. Because let me remind you what's the history of the discussion of this story. Well, for many years, we were looking at models. And when I say models, I mean models without dynamics. For example, one of the famous ones was the fractal, or the so-called beta model. It was introduced by Benoit Mandelbrot and then explained to the world by Frisch, Sulem, and Nelkin, in which one says, well, turbulence is in some sense concentrated on a fractal set, and from this, one, if one knows the fractal dimension, one can say something about anomalous scaling. It didn't work so well because it predicts a linear dependence of the scaling exponents on the moments of the structure function. Then there are models like the multifractal model that Frisch and Parisi has suggested around 86. Well, it was really before, it was published in 86, in which they say, well, the Hölder exponent, that exponent H, which appears when you consider velocity difference ux plus r minus u of x, velocity difference across the length scale r, which is going like r to the h, or is smaller or equal to a constant times r to the h. That h varies depending on where you are in the flow, depends on this x, and as an object of this set on which you'll find the same h will be a fractal set of dimension d of h. If you put into the model a d of h, you get some prediction on the scaling exponents, but again, it's a model without dynamics. Another way is you can guess a distribution function. And there have been a number of guesses that has been going around. I'm talking now about the distribution function for velocity differences. There's been 1962 Kolmogorov guess of log normal. We've heard this morning about the Shea-Levesque guess. And there are various guesses that one can do, and compare the guesses, fit them this way or another to what you see in experiments. Well, another way of thinking has been saying ex cathedra, the reason for anomaly that you measure in the scaling exponents is because there are singular events in the fluid. This is going many, many years back. Recently, there's been a model that was proposed by Kambe, for example. There have been many others, and you may say, well, maybe the most singular event is something like the Berger's vortex, which is an exact stationary solution of Navier-Stokes equations, and then assume that this is there, and compute now what will be the scaling field U, and do this, etc. So there are many, many such approaches, and I think as an approach, in general, they're sort of non-satisfactory in the sense that they leave out the dynamics, they're not really based on the equations of fluid mechanics. On the other hand, there have been attempts at theoretical calculations. When I say this, I mean it's different from modeling in the sense that you want to start with the equations of fluid mechanics and try to see whether you can proceed in a systematic way to compute the exponents that characterize the statistics. Famous has been various closures of the renormalized perturbation theory from Bob Kraken and onward. There have been renormalization group type calculations like Victor Yachot and Orza, Greg Einck. I mean, more recently, the St. Petersburg group, Adjumian, Antonov, and Vasiliev. In my own group with Victor Lvov, we've looked at closures of infinite hierarchies of equations. This is a non-perturbative approach, etc. And even if one succeeds in one of those, and I think there is some good reasons to expect that maybe at some point one of these approaches or a combination of these approaches may give us numbers, this is still not giving us what I said, what I would like to pose as a question, which is, what is the physical mechanism? So even if we have a method of calculation, and this is what I want to stress in this talk, we don't yet necessarily have a physical mechanism. Let me explain what I want to say in this and what I'm trying to focus on. Yes. Agreed. There's been an attempt to understand, I said attempt to understand the scaling properties, and it did not give because it was indeed a regular perturbation theory. It was convergent order by order. I don't want to get into the details. Yes, sir. Let me explain what I have in mind. So what I want to do is explain what I have in mind with the help of two examples. Two examples in which there's been some understanding of what is going on, and the understanding differs, and this is why there's still a question that is begged here. What do we need to think about when we look at the mechanism? So an example that I want to deal with is example of shell models, and actually I want to refer to a paper that I've learned about in a recent meeting in Japan, a paper by Nakano in 1988, which is based on some insightful numerical simulations by Eric Sigia, and I think also by an early paper with Mark Nelkin. And basically, it's very simple. The idea is you write a model, a dynamical equation model, which is known as a shell model, which is a monkey of the Navier-Stokes equations in the sense that it's like an equation for the amplitudes of the Fourier components of the field. The Fourier component is x. The n here stands for the shell. N goes from 1 to infinity, basically, but there's also dissipation that kills the amplitude at some point, so there is a dissipative term. You have the typical quadratic nonlinearity that appears in Navier-Stokes system. It's not a Navier-Stokes problem in the sense that it's one-dimensional. Lambda is the spacing between the shells, so if lambda is 2, then you are talking about k vectors, say, that are a product of 2, 4, 8, 16, etc. And this is a kind of a simple shell model of the type that many people have played with in recent years. I'll explain. I ask the audience to give me some leeway and come back with the questions in 10 minutes. Okay, so what Nakano has done is that let us seek a self-similar solution. What has been a self-similar solution? It's a solution that for xn as a function of t, you're looking for something that looks like this. So it has a scaling function f that does not depend on n. It depends on time, such there is a t minus tn here, and there is a lambda to the zn. What does it mean, this solution? Well, first I have to say, these tn's are a geometric series that is converging. They say Tn minus Tn minus 1 is A, this B is the same as this lambda, so lambda to the minus Zn. So the series of Tn converges into some T star. So this is like going into finite time singularity with lambda being a number larger than 1 means that you are looking at a sharpening solution as a function of n that goes into finite time singularity. This in some sense is similar to the solutions that Bob Kerr is finding, for example, in his Euler solutions. That is to say, it's a scaling solution that as it goes towards sharpening of the solution, it also is living on a smaller and smaller spatial region. Okay, now if you have an assumption of this kind, you can now write equivalently, by putting it back into the equation there, an equation for F itself. So you are now trying to solve a self-similar solution of this type. And let me say, if you had a scaling theory that is Kolmogorov type, any dimensional analysis would say that Z, if such a solution exists, should be two-thirds. Now let's see what the system says. Okay, so you write down an equation of motion for this F, and you're trying to solve it. To solve, of course, you need to have some boundary conditions, and these are reasonable boundary conditions have been chosen. Firstly, this scaling function is positive. Secondly, as S goes to minus infinity, the scaling function goes to zero. And finally, F prime is zero when S is zero. Let us say it has a shape that looks like this, zero, and then it goes up and goes down. It has a maximum, and the maximum shifts with time along the shells and sort of goes into a sort of singularity that is only being smoothed by the viscous term. Now you have here a condition F prime at S equals 0 equals 0. This gives immediately a relationship, if you want, in this equation between A and Z. That is to say, they are not independent. This solution gives you a connection between them. So now what you do, you start with an A. You start with a choice solution for F. You started with Gaussian. You have now an equation df ds, so you can update your function and see whether it converges. And here is how it works. So I'll show you now the numerics of trying to solve that differential equation. Actually, it's very exciting. Because what you see here, maybe I'll change this and do it there. What you actually see when you do this, you see a solution that looks like this. Thank you, Srini. So here is the iterations. You update the thing. You choose an A, and you're looking what is the Z that you get. So every time the function changes, but also the value of Z gets updated. And you see that with two A choices that are different in the ninth position after the period, the two solutions go to the same Z, and then one goes up and one goes down. So you have a hyperbolic fixed point in this problem. That is to say, you are attracted towards a given Z, and only towards the very end, you see the hyperbolicity, and you jump out, and the Z, therefore, this is a way to determine what is a Z that agrees with your self-similar solution, and that Z is not two-thirds. That Z is 0.9-something. Okay, so what is this an example of? This is an example of a dynamical system. Now I'm going back to your question. This is an example, very simple, of a system that is dynamical, that is picking up, that shows us that if you assume that it has a self-similar solution with a blow-up that is self-similar, then the equation itself picks up for you the scaling function and the exponents. And the exponents are non-trivial. They're sort of anomalous. So it's an example of a way to understand anomaly in a simple system. Do we expect, therefore, that also in Navier-Stokes we should look at solutions of this type? Well, I want to argue that we don't know. And we don't know because we have a counterexample, and I want to now discuss that example. That example will be the equation of passive scalar in the Kreyknan model, which we understand, which we now understand completely. The problem is the following. We have a scalar field T that is advected by a velocity U. It has a diffusivity kappa naught. It has some forcing. The model that Kreyknan has a proposal that has gotten a lot of interest in recent years is that you have a Gaussian forcing field and a Gaussian velocity field in the sense that the fluctuations are Gaussian, but the correlations in space are non-trivial, i.e. the velocity correlations scale, this quantity W, when you subtract from it the zero value, has a form that looks like R to the exponent psi, so there is a scaling in the two-point correlation function of the velocity that is pushing the scalar, and this is just the tensorial form that is required by incompressibility. It's a famous model. I don't want to go into much details. And the question that you want to ask, if you have such a velocity field, what are the statistical objects in terms of the scalar field? So the structure function, S to N, which is defined as usual as the temperature differences across the length scale R to nth moment. And if this, you can disregard the R dependence if you have space homogeneous statistics, and if you have isotropy, then this is also only a function of the distance R, and you expect the scaling goes like R to the zeta to N. And the question is, what are the exponents, and why would there or would not be simply computed from dimensional analysis? Theory shows that instead of structure functions, it's much easier to consider the correlation functions, i.e. the correlation functions 2nth order would be the product of the scalar field in 2n spatial positions at the same time. And very quickly, I want to remind you that there's been a lot of theory on this. There is an equation known as the Crichton equation that is solved by these objects. It's a complicated operator here. I don't want to go into details. And people have discussed the ideology that equations of this type have two kinds of solutions. There are the inhomogeneous solutions where the right-hand side of this equation is considered, and there are homogeneous solutions known also as the zero modes, and the zero modes are those that are responsible for the scaling exponents, and you can compute them in some limits analytically, at least in perturbation theory. So this is a computational scheme, but it's not a mechanism. So what I would like to do now is spend a few minutes and discuss the physical mechanism for the anomaly in this case, to give you a counterexample to the singularity scenario, where you don't need, in fact, any singularity. Okay, so this is work that has been developing for a number of years now. It started as an idea of relating the Lagrangian trajectories, some work that has been done simultaneously by the group in Observatoire d'Anis and in my group. Let me just summarize what it looks like. So what you understand is, for a passive scalar, the velocity field is only taking the scalar from one point and puts it in another point. They say the velocity field is just redistributing the scalar in space, and therefore, and is not really changing the value of the scalar. What changes the value of the scalar is the forcing. So if you're interested in knowing what is the scalar at point R0 at time T0, what you need to look at is at the Lagrangian trajectory that ends up its life at time T0 at R0, and at every point solves the Lagrangian equation that the rate of change of R is the velocity, is the velocity field itself plus some noise term, Gaussian noise term, which is written like this, and this will be the value of the scalar where you are taking now the forcing and average over all the possible realization of this random noise. So this is an exact form of the field at point R0 and T0. Now, if you want to look now at the correlation function, what we asked for, the correlation function that is connecting the field at point R1, R2, R3, etc. Okay, if you want to know the correlation function F to N, what you need to put, for every T here, you should put an integral of this kind and make the process of averaging, which is here. And since the forcing is Gaussian, when you take these averages, you pick only the binary correlation xi that depend on R1 minus R2 and xi R2n minus 1 R2n. So you have all the products of these correlation functions of the forces and all the possible permutations, R1 minus R3, R1 minus R4, etc. And you average over all the realizations of the velocity field and the eta I. Okay, so you need to really consider the correlation of all these random forces and integrated over all the times when they're running. Let me explain again what this means. So what you want is the following. Say, for example, that you want a fourth order correlation function, right? And you want a fourth order correlation function between point R1, R2, R3, and R4. So what you realize is that these points are arriving in time from a different place, right? They're coming, for example, from here, due time, they arrive here, the time is right here, and along this trajectory, you collect the random force that is contributing to the value of the scalar at that point at the end. Now, what I want to explicitly state here, that a correlation function is actually something that defines a configuration, i.e., a correlation function, in this case, will define something that has geometry and has scale. And that geometry and scale has come from something which also has a geometry and scale. Okay, so the process of computing a correlation function of this type entails understanding how through the Lagrangian trajectories this shape and scale has ended up in this shape and scale. And what I would like to argue, yes? Yes, yes. And what I'd like to argue to you is that it's the evolution of the shape that determines the anomalous exponents. So let me now come back and say the following. So we are going to characterize a configuration of 2n particles by, say, the center of mass, a scale s, which maybe is the geometric mean of all the distances, and a shape z. In a shape z, you know, every such shape is determined, say, for example, by the angles inside, and the Euler angles determine the orientation of the shape compared to a fixed coordinates. So a shape z has all the angles that are needed to determine a particular shape. This is scale, this is the r, and therefore a group of 2n positions ri will be sometime denoted as r, s, and z. And I'm going to argue that the scale dynamics is never anomalous, i.e. scale goes like t to the 1 over zeta 2, where zeta 2 is 2 minus xi, and there's nothing anomalous in the scale dynamics, it's only the shapes that carry all the anomalous scaling. And this is, in some sense, very different from what we gave as an example for the shell model, where no singularity appears to be needed. Okay, so now we consider shape z0, with an overall scale S0, which is realized at time T0. This is the end point where we are measuring the correlation function. We fix the scale S, larger than S0, and now go back in time, and we examine the shape when this configuration reaches the scale S for the last time. Let's say we're going backwards in time, and we're looking at the evolution towards the final shape Z0 at time T0. It's a random process. So S can grow and decrease, grow and decrease, grow and decrease. We look at it the last time it's S before it decreases to S0. And since we have random realizations of a field U and a forcing, then this shape Z at this scale S belongs to some distribution, which is going to call gamma Z, ZFS, Z0, S going to S0. Then now this is, if you will, a shape-to-shape transition probability that says when I'm finishing at S0, at S0 with a shape Z0, for the last time I've been at S, I had a shape Z. If I have such a distribution, it's very easy, therefore, to define an operator, gamma hat, on any function psi of Z0, which is defined by the integral of gamma on psi Z integration over all Z. This defines an operator gamma. And the argument is the physics and the anomaly is all in the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues of the operator gamma hat. I beg your pardon? The time has been absorbed. Let's say time has been here fixed to be the time at which, for the last moment, you've been at S before you got to S0. So there'll be many, many times like this in a particular experiment. So for every realization, that time is fixed. It's when the scale is S for the last time before reaching S0. Okay?
So, therefore, if you just look at the last time, you might have a distribution of
it's a different distribution. It's a different distribution. I'm not looking at fixed elapsed times. I'm looking now at every set of 2n trajectories that has finished in my target thing. I'm going now backwards, till now backwards, the first time that I'm reaching the scale S, I'm going now again, okay? This will happen now at a different time when I get to scale S. I look what is the shape. I'm doing it again. It'll happen yet at a different time. I'm looking at the distribution. That is the distribution. No. It's the first, it's not integrated over time. This is the distribution of shapes defined in this way. They just say, you look at all the times or all the events that you've been for the last moment, you know, for the last time at a scale S, and you're determining the distribution gamma of the shapes. And you know that you're finishing with Z naught, but you have a distribution of Z. Okay, you'll see momentarily how it works. But it's a well-defined operational thing. Yes, no? Okay. So now I want to define this operator. And what are the properties of these operators? Well, there are essentially two properties that determine everything and the shape of the theory. So, first property is, of course, isotropy. I claim the operator commutes with all rotation operators. It's very simple, because if you go from this shape to this shape, or you go from rotated shape to rotated shape, if the velocity field is isotropic, that, of course, has the same probability. Okay, so I have isotropy in the sense that if O lambda is a rotation operator that takes the function psi of z to a new function psi of lambda minus 1 of z, then O lambda gamma hat and gamma O lambda are the same. That is to say, all rotation operators leave my operator invariant, and as such, it has to be, then its eigenfunctions can be classified by the irreducible representations of all the rotation group, which is the SO3 symmetry group. Let me call this irreducible representation BQLM. L goes 0, 1, 2, 3. M goes between minus L and L. And Q is an added index if I need it, where the definition is operator lambda on BQLM is sum on M prime of D M prime M of BQL M prime. You are mixing the various M primes, and this is just the matrix irreducible representation of the SO3 symmetry group. It has an L on L matrix representation. So this is just a result of the isotropy that I know what are the eigenfunctions. 2L plus 1, sorry, 2L plus 1, yes. 2L plus 1 on 2L plus 1 irreducible matrix representation. Thank you. Okay. The second property is the fact that we have now a field, the velocity field is Gaussian, meaning that if I now go from shape Z to Z0 in two steps, i.e. from Z to Z1 and from Z1 to Z0, where the scale goes from S to S1 and from S1 to S0, integrated over all the intermediate possibilities, this is the same. And for the operator, it says it has this property that gamma of S over S0 is gamma of S over S1, gamma S1 over S0, meaning that the eigenvalues have to be of the form S over S0 to some exponent zeta. That's the only thing that will cancel the S1 to the zeta when I go from here to here, meaning that I know how this operator operates on the eigenfunctions, which are the irreducible representation. It pulls out an S over S naught to the zeta of a BQLM. So I know the operator, I know its eigenfunctions, and I know the form of the eigenvalues. So I'm almost finished. Let me now skip two transparencies for the sake of clarity, and if you want, or if you have some time, come back to it. And believe me that I can derive exactly an equation for the correlation function that is written there. Let's say the correlation function F to N has the following exact equation to solve. It has a term I that I'm going to say in a moment something, and now it has this exact transition probability gamma Z to Z naught when S goes from S naught on the same correlation function F to N of SZ. And this I is a term that in the derivation you can prove does not contain the most dangerous anomalous exponent. If F to N has anomaly, I has at most the anomaly of 2n minus 1. This is the less singular term. Now, if this is the case, then we are done. Because by the Schur lemma, we know that the eigenfunctions of the SO3 symmetric group are complete, and therefore I can write my correlation functions, I can expand them in coefficients times the irreducibles. The same is true for F2n of S0 and F2n of S, and also the I can be expanded in this form due to the completeness, etc., Schur, and all this. Now, I know that due to the linear independence, if I plug this expansion in, the gamma on the BQLM is going to make me an S over S naught to the zeta, as we showed before. This is how the operator operates on the eigenfunctions. And therefore, I see that for every Q, every L, and every N, if I take the coefficients here and I change the scale from S naught to S, I'm bringing out as S over S naught to an exponent zeta, which is exactly the property of homogeneous functions acting independently in every sector of the symmetry group. So, for example, for an isotropic system, I only have L equals 0, M equals 0, Q equals 0. This is only one term, but this is true in all the sectors of the symmetry group. You have here, if you want, a formal proof that scaling exists, that you have a homogeneous function, and the homogeneous functions act such that if I change the scale from S0 to S, I get the scale change. No, because if you have scalar functions, then you don't need Q. Then you know the spherical harmonics will exhaust. But when you have many variables, then you can have more than one irreducible representation with the same L and M, and you need to have more than one Q. So Q is just a label for representation of the same L and M that you need when you have functions of more than one variable. No, you don't need, because they are orthogonal in the sense that the integration against another Q prime LM is also delta Q minus Q prime. Let me see. Because you're not mixing the Q. Because you don't. That is to say, the property of the what I showed before, this property is true. That is to say that the rotation operators are only mixing the M's. So for every Q separately, they're only mixing the M. 1, 2. For example, you can have a system that depends on more than one vector. So a correlation function of third order, a correlation function will depend on two vector distances. And you can have even in Q equals zero, even in L equals zero in the isotropic system, you can have a system, you can have an irreducible representation with helicity or without, and that will give you two different Qs. Fine. So you can have with helicity or without. In this sense, yes. You need an extra symmetry to distinguish between them. Okay, so what we have accomplished, really, we have accomplished here a statement that the spectrum of anomalous exponents is determined by the eigenvalues of the shape-to-shape transition probability operator, and we see here an appearance of anomalous scaling from a process that is very different from what we discussed in the case of the shell models. So for the shell models, we really looked explicitly at the solution that has a singularity. Here there's nothing singular. You have a shape going to a different shape, and there are these transition probabilities, and the process is anomalous because of the following phenomenon. It says, if you have eigenfunctions, that is to say, if you have eigenfunctions in the sense that an operator on an eigenfunction is just eigenvalue times the same, it means that I can now arrange a distribution of shapes, initial shapes, that will be according to the eigenfunction in the space of shapes, and that, by the dynamics, is only multiplied by a number which looks like S over S naught or some exponent, but is not changing. There's a, as an eigenfunction, is not changing. Being not changing, it means it's stationary to the dynamics. Being stationary to the dynamics, it will contribute to the statistics enormously. In fact, it will be the only thing that will appear eventually in the statistics of this. So when you look at a given shape that is eventual a shape, then I can now look at all those initial shapes that are distributed in a form that is like the eigenfunctions, and that will go unchanged and will not be mixed by the dynamics, only be multiplied by a scale factor which makes it a scaling homogeneous function, with this exponent being the eigenvalue of the shape-to-shape transition probability. So we have here a very different, if you want, mechanism for anomaly, and the question is now think about Navier-Stokes, which one will prevail? Answer is, I don't know. And answer is, very little has been discussed. I think the one paper that I've seen recently that comes to ask this question in an intelligent way is the paper by Boris Schreiman, Alain Pohomir, and Misha Chertkov, where they have tried to look at the problem not in most generality, but for 4 points, tetrads, where I smell, I didn't quite understand the paper, and I hope that you know, we can use these days or another another case to learn a little bit more. But there are the ingredients. As I say, there is a shape-to-shape transition probability. There's also the smell through the VFOS tail and the solution of the singularities. And my feeling is that that paper is telling us that for the Navier-Stokes, the mechanism will be an amalgamation of the two, singularity and shape dynamics. But I really don't know much more, and I think maybe Boris wants to add a few words to this, but I'm just decided I want, for the first day, to raise this up as a question for the program: what is the mechanism for anomaly scaling in the case of Navier-Stokes? And I think I'll stop here, and I thank you very much for your attention. It's again because of this Markov property that I quickly try to show here. That is, you need the operator to be able to take you from shape 1 to shape 2, shape 2 to shape 3, like from 1 to 3. And if you check how it will work, it cannot be a sum. Yeah. You mean E to something. I mean, that's a possibility. For the case of the Markov property, you can rule this out. No. For the case of the Markov property, when you analyze what's the possibility, it's the only way. However, when you have non-Markov properties, like in the Navier-Stokes with a finite memory, then it's a different story. Yes, Boris. You mean the one here? I actually didn't show the... I didn't show the derivation of this equation, but you don't need to assume this. I mean, if you want, I can show... I mean, how do we do in terms of time? Okay. So, you know, but you can actually derive this equation exactly without approximations. I mean, you don't need it. Only thing that you need is the Markov property. They say that you can always stop at a certain scale and start all over again, and there is no memory. Yeah. No, it's part of the model, yeah. Yes. And what is the mechanism? Yeah, but what is the mechanism? Oh, shocks. Oh, I don't believe this because of the pressure. That is to say, okay, I mean, I think that you would agree that the phenomenon of shocks is generic to all problems without pressure. However, when you have a pressure, you integrate over all space, I think that the shock phenomenon will disappear, and this is not going to work for the Navier-Stokes. But I agree that that's a third mechanism, but my judgment is that it will not appear in Navier-Stokes. Yeah. And it does have shocks, and I think people have discussed the effect of the shocks on giving you a roof to the anomalous exponents, but that's another story. I didn't discuss two-dimensional Hebron zone. Oh, I see. Yeah, but you know, I don't care much whether you do it in SO3 or SO2 and on SOD. I mean, I just want, I mean, actually, the idea here of doing it in one go in all the sectors of the symmetry group is just because it's cheap. You know, I could have a discussion just of the isotropic problem, and then you'll never ask this. I will only tell you about one typical eigenfunction, which is in the isotropic sector. But, you know, since it's so cheap here to do it in one go in all the sectors of the symmetry group, you know, without any further ado, that I did it. But, you know, it doesn't matter in which dimension you do it. It just will change these eigenfunctions and the q's, you know, depending how many different irreducible representations you have for every L and N. But that's a technicality. Yes, sir.